right? And what it's entailing is we're just supposed to talk about baseball and how it has to do with Pennsylvania. And I know you probably know more about Pittsburgh and Western Pennsylvania more so than Pennsylvania in general. So I'm just gonna start out with a couple of general questions and then try to move into more specifics. Okay. First question I have here jotted down is, why do you think baseball is special?
Best way I can describe it, Marty, is that it's the only game that really has not changed intrinsically, basically since the turn of the century. The angles all work. The distances all work. 60 feet, 6 inches, still works.
Right.
90 feet, still works. Three strikes, four balls. It works. And so they haven't had to tamper with the basic game. Now, okay, they've jazzed the baseball up on occasion. They've enforced a balk rule on occasion. They've come up with a DH, which I don't like because I'm a purist. I'm a National League fan, grew up that way. I don't like the DH for a lot of reasons. And, you know, it's the game that seems to be in tune with the human mind and human body, more so than any other game.
Okay, so I guess what you're trying to say is baseball is the perfect game.
I don't know if it's perfect. I don't think there is such a thing as a perfect game, but I think it is the game that appeals most to human beings because there's no clock. You know, human beings, we're saddled with a clock. For all of us, the clock is ticking.
Right.
In baseball, it doesn't. So that timelessness adds to the charm, and it also presents with it human problems. That last out, many times, is the toughest one to get.
Right.
And so therefore, I grew up as a baseball fan. I've never had the pleasure of broadcasting baseball, but I love the game.
Okay. And do you think this timelessness, is that what you would say is its defining character? How would you define its character?
Yeah. I would say that and the fact that you can be a very successful individual performer, whether it be batter, runner, fielder, pitcher, you can be very, very successful and still have to play and use that success within the team concept. I'd say football is the ultimate team game because the ball doesn't move if all 11 men on offense don't do their job properly. And conversely, you can't stop somebody unless all 11 men on the defense do their jobs properly.
Right.
But in baseball, one man can win a game. One man can end the game with a strikeout. In football, it's not that easy. In hockey, it's certainly one man can end a game with a goal, but still it takes the goalie's cooperation to make that possible. So that's not, in baseball, there's cooperation from the pitcher, but that's a given. I think that's it. I really think that's its major attraction, the fact that, individuals perform within the team concept, and yet individuals can be themselves.
Okay. Now, individualism, I think, is a basic part of the American psyche. So, you feel the same way, and could you say that is the reason why it's the national pastime? Or do you think there's some other aspect of the game that...
Well, I think it became the national pastime because of timing, and also the fact that it is a game played in the summertime, basically, and when people generally have more time to be outdoors and enjoying the sunshine and the breeze and the bird singing and all that sort of thing. And I think that's why people tended to gravitate toward it. Football, I think, for many, many years was considered for ruffians. That's changed now, but I think in its early times, and with the flying wedge and the leather helmet and people losing teeth, it was rather barbaric to a degree. And I think baseball, even though people got hit with baseballs, it wasn't considered so. It was considered more of a gentleman's game, more of a pastime than it was a sport.
Okay, now you mentioned something about timing. What do you mean by that? Like the timing?
Oh, the timing. In other words, the timing of the Industrial Revolution,
okay. The
timing of people in small towns rallying around the local heroes, and generally they were baseball players. And this is in a time, however, when there wasn't television, when people would, on a Sunday afternoon, go down to the local ballpark just to watch a baseball game. Now they don't do that because there's one on TV played by, the best in the business. And so therefore, that has changed. And that's probably why football has surpassed baseball in terms of popularity, if you want to argue that. I don't want to argue that.
Okay.
It seems to me that nothing right now is more successful than the National Football League in terms of what it's able to attract, because maybe people have changed.
Okay. Now, you said the Industrial Revolution was could be a major factor in determining the expansion of baseball and its popularity. Now, Pittsburgh being an industrial town, or used to be, some people might argue, do you think Pennsylvania contributed a lot to baseball, or did baseball, do you think, maybe had more of an influence on Pittsburgh or Pennsylvania?
Well, that's a, cart and horse story, and it's hard to determine which. There's a lot of both. But I think Pennsylvania certainly has contributed a lot. If you want me to sit and start naming names, I could probably start doing that, and I know I'll leave some out, and that would be incomplete as a result. But in terms of the number of great Major League Baseball players we have sent to the game, you think of names like Stan Musial, Dick Grote, I do believe Hank Sauer was a Western Pennsylvanian. We've had our share, that's for sure. Ken Griffey, and Junior. We have to claim Junior, even though he's a generation or two removed. We've had our contributions to the game from that standpoint, but also the game has affected us. I never saw it, but Butler used to have a minor league team.
Right.
Erie, I think, still does have minor. The towns had their teams, and if they weren't, professional teams and organized teams, they were semi-pro teams that represented the community.
Right.
And so, the Industrial Revolution, people worked in a mining town. If that mining town had a baseball team, they wore their pride on that team's sleeve.
Right.
And Sunday afternoons and whenever they could get off to let this thing happen, communities would battle each other in this way and have their little rivalries and enjoy them. And I think that's why I bring in the Industrial Revolution. I think it really came along at the same time that baseball was blossoming, and one grabbed the other, and I think that's why it became the national pastime.
Okay, now I wanted to talk about something a little bit more recent. The baseball strike. Okay, do you feel that's affected baseball in any way? And
well, I said in 1981 that I thought that baseball wouldn't recover from that strike. It did, and I thought that the other work stoppages would hurt it as well. But people, even though they get mad when there's a work stoppage and you can't watch baseball, for whatever reason, they go back and forgive. Somebody tells me this time around, fans are really turned off, and again, my track record is not a good one because I said it before, but this time around seems to be different. First of all, the hard feelings are much deeper than maybe even we suspect. I mean, the owners are going to show the players, and the players are going to show the owners, and then who gets caught in it? You and me.
Right.
We're the people who end up suffering. Okay, I'm sure there are some ball players who have three different condos they're making payments on, or a couple of BMWs, and they may have to, concentrate on this one payment and forget the other stuff.
Right.
But we're the ones deprived. I also feel very bad in this situation for the people who work at the ballparks and whose livelihoods around the ballpark depend on the fact that there's a crowd there at a baseball game. Parking lot attendance, you name it. I mean, there's a lot of people suffering because of this thing. And it's money that they'll never retrieve. I mean, it's gone forever.
Right.
And like I say, the hard feelings here, plus the fact that I think the average guy in these tight economic times who has trouble making ends meet, and the wife and the man together with incomes having trouble getting the family on solid financial ground, I really think that they're looking at it and saying, wait a minute, these millionaires want more.
Right.
And, okay, the other side of the coin is, the Baltimore Orioles franchise sold for $12 million in 1979. Today it's worth $175 or $80 million. So there must be something attractive about owning a baseball franchise. I'm not saying that the players are completely wrong. The players are completely wrong, or the owners are completely wrong, but I'm saying they're all wrong. Right. And the fan is suffering. And until the fan speaks his mind or holds out or stays away or boycotts the products sold by Major League Baseball, then they'll probably not get the message. I'm talking about the owners and the players. They're probably just business as usual, and it's time for another strike. Something tells me this one's a little different. Something tells me this one is going to have far-reaching, long-lasting effects.
Now, you being a sportscaster in Pittsburgh, have you heard anything maybe on the inside? I don't want to break any news stories that you might have later on tonight or anything like that.
I'd be happy to do it if I had one.
you don't have...
I don't have any insight. I don't know
what's
going to happen. No. First of all, Donald Fear made sure the players would talk. We can't even get to them.
Right.
Except for Jay Bell and the other, Tim Foley. Tom Foley. I'll be all right. Tom Foley, the other player. Jeff King lives in Pittsburgh. He wouldn't talk for us because he was instructed not to. So I don't really know anything. It may be coming down. My guess is it'll be back next year. I'm taking my cue from Charlie Huff, who just retired, and Charlie, speaking as the next player and now as a fan, he thinks that he'll settle it and be back in the spring, but I wonder. I really wonder. I think that bad blood is really thick.
Also, that may be wrong or right, I'm not sure, but are they thinking about selling the Pirates?
Well, they have to be sold.
They have to?
Yeah,
what's going on
consortium can't go any farther with this project. And it saved baseball, and now we've got to take the next step. Hopefully, the ownership that could involve the Rooneys and possibly the local cable TV company and some other high-profile people like Dan Marino said that he's interested. Hopefully that can be put together. And if that can be put together, then we won't be immediately threatened with the loss of the franchise.
Oh, okay. Like that was my next question. If somebody, an outsider from another town buys...
All you got to know about that is Elroy Face told me that the guy, and I don't remember his name, came in from Charlotte, said to Mark Sauer, here's a check. I'm going to sign this check. You fill in the amount. It can be whatever you want it to. You just put a number there. And fine, I'll pay that. But in 10 minutes, that club's going to Charlotte. And, of course, Mark Sauer was not empowered to do that, but it's a good thing because I think it would be bad for baseball if this great traditional franchise, one of the earliest ones, would be lost and we'd have to get a backup team in here.
How do you think that would affect the average fans here?
It would affect them a lot, especially if we ended up with an American League team, because these people here are basically National League, have always been, and they would have trouble identifying with an American League team.
So you feel even if the Pirates do move, another team would move into Pittsburgh?
I would think that at some point in time they'd try it again, yes.
Okay.
Under better circumstances, a better lease arrangement, a better ballpark. That's not a ballpark, that's a stadium. There's a big difference.
All right. Does being a sportscaster give you a special viewpoint on baseball? I mean, as opposed to the players or the owners or the people who work the ground?
Well, sure. I think... as a sportscaster, if you're doing your job correctly, you're representing the fan. You're asking the questions that the fans are asking. Why this? Why that? Why not this? Why not that? And so therefore, I think we have kind of a unique role in the situation. We're closer to the fan than the ballplayer is, than the owner is, because we represent. We first of all are fans,
right,
if we're doing our jobs well.
Right.
But secondly, we represent the fan. And I think sometimes when players refuse us interviews and turn their backs on us and that type thing. Okay, they have their reasons, and if they do that, I think I could live with it. But they have to remember that they're turning their backs on the fans when they do that. And I don't think they want to do that.
Okay.
I don't think a player wants to turn his back on a fan. You got to remember who's paying the freight.
Okay, so you feel that the sportscaster then is like the representative of the fans?
Yes.
Okay.
That's our job.
All right. Okay, now... I believe you grew up around Pittsburgh?
Yes,
okay.
in the city proper, Garfield, which is in the East End section.
Okay, what's your first experience that you remember with baseball?
My dad took me to Forbes Field. I saw Danny Murtaugh play second base. I saw Ralph Kiner hit home runs. I saw the O'Brien twins. I saw Dick Groat, and then you kind of move forward to the 71 championship team and the 79 championship team. So my earliest recollection was Danny Murtaugh playing second base, and and who was the guy that went to Cleveland, the left fielder? Gene Woodley. I remember him. So I was around 10 or 11 years old, which would have been 1950 or 51, when I first had a recollection of Forbes Field. Also, I grew up in Garfield, which up on a hill, we could see the lights at Forbes Field at night. So it was always a constant reminder, hey, there's a baseball game going on. And of course, in those days, Rosie Rosenwell's voice would come over the radios from porches in my neighborhood, people listening to the ball game. That doesn't happen anymore either. First of all, it's a porch, but it's in the back of the house.
Right.
And it's far removed from anybody else, and there's no communal sense. Everybody's off doing their own thing. And it's not a radio, probably, chances are it's a TV now. But I do remember that. That was the most vivid memory that, you know, as a youngster growing up, I can recall.
Wow. That's pretty interesting. Do you think TV, I mean, switching from first no radio, and then radio, and then to TV, do you think that's impacted the sport?
Oh, sure.
And I guess the fans in the area?
Yeah, television has had a profound impact on all of sports. Most of it good, some of it bad. Some of it fixable, much of it irreparable. You know, let's face it, that was a period in time where people sat on their porches. They don't do that anymore.
Right.
So it's a whole different society that we're in now. A society geared very much to television. Baseball certainly has used television, especially with the ratings it gets with the World Series and the playoffs. Sort of sorry to see the game of the week kind of go by the boards, but cable TV has impacted that too. It used to be that if NBC would put a Saturday afternoon game on between two really good teams, that a lot of the nation would tune in just to see what was going on. But now, I'm not going to watch that if the Pirates are going to come on that night on the cable, or,
right.
You know what I'm saying? It's fragmented now. You can do more what you want to do as an individual. You don't have to sit around and wait for anybody, NBC or anybody, to hand you a baseball game. You know, you get a satellite dish, you can go punch one up if it's not scrambled.
So you feel then fans now, instead of identifying with the entire game, they identify only with their team, and they're like factionalized.
I think more so, because more of the local team is available
right. On
cable. It used to be that the Pirates only televised 38 games a year. And that was not that long ago. But now, with cable, they're on just about all the time. And it's rare that they're not on.
And do you think this has hindered maybe the progress of farm teams or
yes, no question.
Sandlot teams?
I'm not going to go watch a Pony League or an American Legion game at my local field if the Pirates are on at night. I wouldn't ever make the decision to watch the live game with young kids as opposed to what you might call the real thing. Although the real thing is not the same as it was 30 years ago. The game has slipped. The people playing the game don't play it as well as they used to.
What do you think?
Generally speaking, the pitching's not as good. If they expand again, we'll have pitchers extending their careers into their 50s. If Charlie Huff may unretire. Nolan Ryan may come out of retirement if there's another expansion. There's not enough pitchers to go around. Last year, the average earned run average in the National League was 3.50. I don't know what it was this year. That's high. When I was a kid growing up, if you were over 330, you were getting ready to be shipped back to the minor leagues. And now the average is 350. Pitching is just not as good. You don't see the hit and run as often. You don't see people giving themselves up to advance the baseball. You don't see smart baseball because the product is diluted. There aren't enough good baseball players to go around to all of the major league teams. And so therefore the product is really not as good as it used to be. Now I may sound like a traditionalist who is, things ain't what they used to be. Well, in baseball they're not. I think football's gotten better. Hockey, the pool of talent has increased now. We have European players, more kids in America skate. So the pool's getting bigger. Basketball, there always were a lot of players. Baseball is shrinking. The kids don't play as much baseball now, and plus there are too many teams. You can see it with the 20-game winner is almost unheard of these days. And when I was a kid growing up, the Cleveland Indians had four on the same staff. Four 20-game winners. And 20 games now, you only have to win 12 or 13 to be considered a real good, effective starter in this day and age. Of course, you know, the use of the bullpen has increased, and that's part of it. But still, there aren't enough good pitchers.
Cadillacs.
Come on in, sorry. Reverend, that's okay. We're doing a little college project here.
I gotta ask you a question. Delvin Miller did not die, did he?
Who said?
Well, you read this morning's paper. It refers to Meadowcroft Village and Albert Miller, its founder, and his brother, the late Delvin Miller.
He did die.
I didn't think so.
He was at the Adios.
Yeah,
well, that would have been a major story.
I'll show you the piece of it.
Okay.
Okay, what do you feel is the best examples of baseball, more or less the Pirates, before and, like, long ago, and then today, like then and now? I get either players or team owners or managers who most exemplified what the game meant and stood for.
Well, I think, you know, I'm prejudiced, but again, that's my time warp. I belong to that era as a fan growing up more so than I do now. I'm not a fan growing up now. I'm a fan who's middle aged and beyond. The 60 Pirates will always be my favorite team because that team was, first of all, an overachieving team. They weren't as talented as the Yankees that year. The Yankees pounded them in 3 games, but the Pirates won the close games. To me, that's the true champion. The Pirates were a smart team. Dick Crook once said to me that the Pirates, day in, day out, put 6.5 coaches on the field. Not play, I'm talking about coaches, right? Guys who were really bright, into the game, had good instincts, and knew where to position themselves, and pitchers knew how to pitch. And they didn't have to be taught as much as maybe today's player is. So the 60 Pirates will always be my favorite team. 71 was great. Clemente was as great a baseball player as ever walked on a field. 79, I got to cover that with Bob Prince down in Baltimore and also here back and forth. And that was a great experience. But none will ever be as impactful on me as the 1960 experience.
That's quite all right. Okay, let's see here. Oh, yeah, I wanted to ask you about Roberto Clemente, the new memorial statue mm-hmm. that they put up for him. How do you feel about him as a person? And from what I understand, he used to be laughed at whenever he was playing, and then as soon as the accident happened, somehow Pittsburgh put him on this pedestal. Is that how you see it?
I don't think so. I think that's, that may be somebody's view. He was always a guy who was not easy to understand because he wouldn't let people get to know him that well. He always wanted to keep a distance with people. But I remember him as a warm, friendly, he didn't always get along with the media that well, but I wasn't in the media then. You know, I was kind of a kid trying to become a media person, and, you know, he certainly had all the skills. I mean, he could throw the ball, he could hit it with authority, had great base running instincts, had a great style and a flair, you know, the basket catch and the arm that threw it on a rope and the devil-may-care swagger that he had, you know, I mean, he was good and he knew it. And he was colorful. I mean, if there's one word to describe Roberto Clemente, he was colorful. He had style, great style. And obviously was a great baseball player. Dick Crook once said nobody ever was given more skills by the Lord than Roberto Clemente. Nobody. I think his little distancing from the media and the fact that he had a language barrier made his early years somewhat more stormy than they should have been.
Right.
He probably, when he matured and perhaps mellowed a little bit, would look back on it himself and say, yeah, I made some mistakes, but that's part of being a young kid, that's part of being a foreign kid with another language coming into a culture that's a little bit different, maybe a lot different. As a person, I mean, how can you ever, ever question a man as a human being who died in the manner he died? I mean, he was trying to help somebody
right,
he didn't even
right,
know.
Right.
You know, Nicaragua was a pretty good hike from Puerto Rico.
And
maybe not culturally. Oh, Pittsburgh gets a light year. But I remember him. I remember one time I got to play in one of those media games, and we played either against the coaches or with the coaches against somebody else. And I hit a ground ball short, which one of the other media or somebody didn't field it, and it went all the way to the left field wall because nobody caught up with it. And so I'm chugging around the bases, and finally I come around third, and they're waving, okay, and I go to slide, and I mean there's mud all over me. I got a raspberry on my can. I got up slowly, you know, I'm just And I remember looking in the dugout and seeing Clemente, he's just roaring, laughing at me, doing what I just did, hitting an inside the park home run between a shortstop's legs, you know, which was the quality of baseball that was played in this. But, you know, he got a kick out of that. That warm smile, I'll never forget. He had that warm smile.
And do you think that the players, I mean, he was a great player and person during his time. Do you think the players nowadays even come close? Like Barry Bonds?
Barry Bonds, don't get me wrong. Barry Bonds is a great, great player. But if you want to make a comparison between the two of them, as a hitter, Barry Bonds may be better. Barry Bonds, according to Dick Groat, who knows a lot more about hitting a baseball than I do, said he's not only the best lefty against lefties he's ever seen, but he's the best two-strike hitter in the game today, Barry Bonds, because he changes his swing to accommodate the strike zone and make sure that he stays alive and makes contact. Maybe as a hitter, Bonds might be greater, but as a fielder, and I'll just cite one example, and that's when Sid Bream scored the winning run for the Atlanta Braves in Game 7. That base hit to left field by Francisco Cabrera, a name we shall never forget. I could just see Clemente picking that ball up. First of all, Bream wouldn't have turned third. And then the next thing you see, Barry Bonds' throw is up the line. If it's anywhere close to home plate, Spanky has a shot making the tag, but not if it's up the line. I would never see Clemente making a critical mistake in that situation, throwing it that wide. It wouldn't happen. So I think the comparison ends right there. So overall greatness, Clemente's a great ball player.
All right, that's pretty much what I have. Is there anything else you'd like to mention?
No, it's just, I hope they get the thing resolved, and I'll probably be the first one to come back and forgive everybody, but boy, they just tore down a great season.
Right.
I mean, you had so many people going after some really great records that nobody ever thought they'd be challenged. Jeff Bagwell, and Frank Thomas, and Ken Griffey Jr., you know, they were going after. You're taking away Tony Gwynn's last opportunity. Probably ever. I hope he comes back and wins another batting title, but you know what I'm saying? So many things going on this year, and now, where'd they go? What do you do to this season? Put an asterisk beside it? We don't have a World Series champion. We had two World Wars and had World Series champions.
Right.
There's something wrong with that. That's wrong.
Thanks.
Okay. Sure.
Yeah.
Happy to do it.
Wow. That's good. I think maybe only the guy doing Chuck Tanner is going to outdo on this interview. And then he's going to have to...
Well, he's going to have to edit it. That'll be a full-time project.